We're in 2 Corinthians chapter 11. 2 Corinthians chapter 11. And going to take attempt to finish the chapter here from verses 13 through 33. 13 through 33. And as I mentioned in trying to outline the chapter, we have the first three verses talks about Paul's direction, where he wants to take the Corinthians. He wants to with his godly jealousy, present them as a chaste virgin. So this is the direction he wants to take them. But in order to do that, he has to deal with the deception. They have been deceived here, so that's verse 4. And so he uses a sarcasm indicating that you will receive the worst of the worst false prophets around. You'll receive them, but you struggle with me. Type of approach that he had. So you'll bear well with them, but you won't bear well with me. That's 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 4. They'll preach another Jesus, another spirit, and another gospel, and you know better. You've rejected all this, but nevertheless you'll listen to these false preachers who happen to be in the church, these false apostles. But me, who has started the church, I have won you to Christ. I've baptized some of you, and I've been with you. I'm kind of a second-class citizen here, and so on. So you see, the Corinthian church was one of the Lord's churches, but the Corinthian church coming out of a very immoral background, if they weren't careful, they carried their carnality into the, not only did they carry a carnality in, but they had a tendency to live in a carnal life. Now, the key here is we all have that tendency unless we're filled with the Holy Spirit. We need to be Spirit-filled every day. Otherwise, we're going to be carnal and think carnally and behave carnally and do the most carnal things. And when it comes down here to the Corinthian church, he had to rebuke them. He did this. Verse 4 is a classic example of sarcasm in the Bible. So he had to rebuke them on that. Then we see in verses 5 through 33, the rest of the chapter, Paul begins to defend himself. And he began to defend himself, first of all, with about his person, who he was personally, verses 5 through 12. And then secondly, he had to defend himself positionally in verses 13 through 33, positionally. Now, he makes this clear that he has to boast of what the blessings and the privileges the Lord has given him in his believer's life. He has to boast in these things. Not because he wants to, but to show a contrast with what he has endured and what the false prophets haven't endured. So that's what he's trying to do here. In fact, he makes it clear in verse 17. It says, that which I speak it not after the Lord, but as it were foolishly in this confidence of boasting. So in other words, the Lord during his earthly ministry never had to boast of the hardships that he endured. He never did that. He didn't need to do that, and he never did. But Paul is doing this only because he's speaking to a group of professed believers, the Corinthian church, and he's letting them know what he has had to endure to be a blessing to them. He doesn't want to have to do this, but they need to hear this. In contrast to the false prophets, who were there to, as he indicates, to keep them in bondage and to devour them. This probably had to do with the devouring them financially. This is what the false prophets do. They work off of people's finances. So you give me your money and I'll tell you something spiritually. That's what the false prophets do. We mentioned this in cult's class, so Daryl here knows all about Reverend Ike. Reverend Ike was a black preacher down there in Harlem, and he went around and he made money off of the poor people in Harlem. As he drove around in, what was it, 18 Rolls Royces? He had 18 Rolls Royces, but he was a preacher to many of the blacks in Harlem, and he made money off of the poor. You know, and what an aberration. But there are others out there. They do the same thing. They do the same thing. You send your money into me, and I'll give you some sort of spiritual blessing. I'll pray for you, or whatever it is. But they're out there, and they have a great deal of wealth. Where do they get the wealth? You see, where do they get the wealth? They get it from those that contribute to them. Now, obviously, there is a financial plan that Lord has for churches. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about something where there's just an abuse of all this. So Paul has to deal with them in a very unusual way, and that is to use the sarcasm, as it were, and then to boast on the things he endured to demonstrate he was a true apostle in contrast to the false apostles that were in the church. If you look there, we'll get to this verse, but if you look there in verse 13, he says, for such are false apostles. There were false apostles back then. And there are today, by the way, false apostles today. But they were in the Corinthian church. So this church apparently was fairly large by this time. And within were these that were trying to undermine the people who were in places of leadership. And in the meantime, they're also destroying the testimony of Paul and undermining him. So Paul had to defend himself. So this is a significant section of 2 Corinthians at the tail end of the book. So in attempting to look at this section now, 13 through 33, I've divided this into three major sections. And first of all, my first point here is the nature of the devilish ministers, verses 13 through 15. Secondly, there's the nature of their deceptive minds. The nature of their deceptive mind, 16 through 21. And then there's finally Paul, the nature of his defensive mode. He has to defend himself. All right. So I've organized it this way. But first of all, let's look at the nature of the devilish ministers that were in the church here. And verse 13, he says, for such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into the apostles of Christ. And no marvel, for Satan himself is transformed into the angel of light. Therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers also be transformed as the ministers of righteousness, whose end shall be according to their works. So, he points out, false apostles. Now, later on in the book of Revelation, if you look there in Revelation chapter 2, Paul addresses the Ephesian church. So this is about 40 years later in the Ephesian church, not the Corinthian church, but this is in the Ephesian church. But in Revelation chapter 2, verse 2, he addresses the Ephesian church. Now remember, the Ephesian church was started right after the Corinthian church, so they have the same starting point chronologically, but we're 40 years later. He says in Revelation 2, 2, I know thy works and thy labor and thy patience, and how thou canst not bear them which are evil, and thou hast tried them which say they are apostles and are not, and hast found them liars. These, for a 40-year span, there were these false apostles. So they were attempting to get into churches and destroy the churches. There were false apostles. Now keep in mind, I've said this many times, but Satan never creates anything. He destroys the present creation. He has destroyed the present heavens and earth through his sin and deception of Adam and Eve. He gets in and destroys New Testament churches. He never starts a church. He destroys them. He never started the office of apostleship. He sends in false apostles, you see. And so he destroys the Bible. He never wrote the Bible. He destroys the Bible. He's a destroyer. And he comes in and he destroys local churches. And he does this through human agency. And so here we have men. Verse 13, these were actual men who claimed to be apostles. And yet Paul says that they're false apostles. Now, Scripture is very clear here. There were qualifications for apostles, Acts chapter 1. And of all those that were qualified, there's only two that came forth that could fill Judas's place there in Acts chapter 1. And so now Paul is called an apostle by Luke in Acts 13:13 and other places. So Paul was an apostle, but there were also false apostles. Now the expression false apostles only found here. It's the one word in the Greek, but it's only found here, false apostle. Excuse me. But he's talking about their involvement here in the Corinthian church. Now, in a church that has several leaders, church is big enough to have several leaders, and remember the Corinthian, or rather the church there in Jerusalem, they had thousands of members there at Pentecost and following, and the 12 apostles then were the leaders. And then they were overcome with the widows, and so they had to choose deacons. But then as churches got smaller, normally there would be only one or two pastors and so on. But here, the Corinthian church may have been fairly large, but there were false apostles. And then he goes on to say, and he qualifies them, they were deceitful workers. Oh, they were involved, but they were being deceitful in their involvement. They really had their own agenda. So churches need to know what is the biblical agenda. And in Bible Baptist Church, we've got one agenda. That is to glorify the Lord, practice the Great Commission. That's the one agenda. We don't have personal agendas here going on. We don't have social agendas going on and so on and so forth. We've got one agenda here. But some will come in and have their own agenda and act like they're part of the big movement here, but they really got their own. And only it is the controlling of others. It's the controlling of others. Controlling people. Control people, and you control their wealth. All right, so deceitful workers. So they were coming in. Notice he says, uses the word transforming. This word shows up several times here in the passage. Transforming in verses 13, 14, and 15. But the Greek word behind this is meta, schematic, or schemidzo. And so meta schematic, a schematic, you know what a schematic is, kind of a skeleton outline. But the use of it here has to do with transforming the external. Kind of like some people do at Halloween time, they put on a false face. They're transforming the external. And that's what these individuals were doing. They weren't transforming the heart, the internal. They were putting on veneer here that wasn't legitimate. They were transforming themselves externally. And likewise, Satan, in verse 14, for Satan himself transformed, same word, into an angel of light. He transforms himself into an angel of light. Here these individuals were transforming themselves into the apostles of Christ. They came, no doubt, in there and said, I'm an apostle of Christ. Look how I put on the show. Look how holy I look. Look how godly I am. And they put on a show, and they did this all externally. And it looked good, and it's easy to catch people in all this, and that's what Paul was concerned about. But inwardly, they were not true apostles. It was all external. They were hollow people, appearing and attempting to be like the apostles of Christ. And so they put on this externality. And where did they get this idea of putting on externality? Well, they got from Satan. He appeared as an angel of light. He transforms himself into an angel of light. Now, here is a verse that Joseph Smith should have known. We've mentioned this before and went through cults Sunday school, but supposedly Joseph Smith, as he was involved in the occult and so on, he had Christ, he said, appeared to him at the foot of his bed, or an angel, actually an angel. It keeps changing. Was it Christ or an angel? He had a couple names for the angel. One was Moroni, so we coined the expression there, Moroni Baloney. So when you think of Mormonism, just think of Moroni baloney, all right? And that's some assessment of that false religion, a lot of baloney. But he transformed himself into an angel of light. And so this Moroni said, I'm an angel from God, and you have been handpicked to carry on the movement of Christianity, which has been lost. And so I want you to take up the banner for the Latter-day Saints. And I want you to head up the Church of the Latter-day Saints, because for hundreds of years, the movement of truth has stopped. But I have come to you, and you've been the hand-chosen person, and he fell for that. And they started the Mormon Church, the Latter-day Saints, Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. All that sounds good, but every word there is false. It's not the Lord's church. All right, anyway, and then verse 15, he goes on to say concerning the nature of devilish ministers. Therefore is no great thing if his ministers also be transformed as the ministers of righteousness. See, they put on this external mode of righteousness. Oh, we're godly, we're holy, we care about people, we're doing this for people and so on. And it is not legitimate. Notice he says, whose end shall be according to their works. So the Lord is going to look at their works, and ultimately their so-called works of righteousness really are self-serving part of their agenda, and there's really no righteousness there. The Lord condemns self-righteousness and the works of righteousness and so on. And so he begins to expose the nature of these devilish ministers. And so there are many out there who think they know the Lord. They have done things in the name of the Lord. Matthew 7, Lord, Lord, have we not done this and so on? The Lord indicates, no, I never knew you. Some of these preachers here and so on. I've listened to, since somebody said they wanted to get home and listen to Joel Osteen, I listened to him several times. And, you know, he doesn't teach a message of repentance. Doesn't teach the true gospel here and so on. But, boy, he's a fantastic speaker. I mean, people could listen to him for hours, and he could, he could convince you of anything. Very encouraging and so on and so forth. But it's a self, or it's a shallow encouragement. And the Jesus that he's talking about is not the Lord. All right, so, but there are many, many out there. They sound good, but you have to listen to their message. There's many of these false preachers out there. Internet, YouTube, and TV, and radio, and everywhere else. They're out there. Benny Hinn, of course, he was a false prophet. He came to Pat Robertson's school one time, and my son Aaron, Molly and or Maddie and Mackenzie's father, he went to one of these tent meetings as an observer, a theological observer, not a participant. But he said there was all kinds of things going on there that were weird. And I think he challenged one of the workers there about some of this. I mean, sometimes my son Aaron would be challenging face to face and so on. But these people are false teachers, apostles, or ministers, whatever they are. And they've got their own agenda. And ultimately, it's controlling people, and if you control people, you can control their money. It gets back to finances, really. Many of these ministries are, the preachers are wealthy. I mean, they have all kinds of wealth. You check them out. They live in mansions. They have mobile cars. They have all this wealth. And, and there's nothing wrong with having things as long as you don't make that your love. You can put the Lord first. Now, he can bless and give you physical things and finances and so on. But anyway, we see the nature then. They're devilish ministers. So even though they may look kind and they're slick and they sound good, many of them have the devil behind them. You see, and so they want to destroy people ultimately. And they're the self-deceived. See, they're self-deceived. As unregenerate people, they're self-deceived. By the way, that's the worst kind of deception, being self-deceived. All right, so anyway, there's the nature of the devilish minister. Secondly, there's the nature of the Corinthians' deceptive minds here. Verses 16 through 21. Notice Paul has to say to them, I say again, let no man think me a fool, if otherwise, yet as a fool receive me, that I may boast myself a little. In other words, fools boast about how great they are. They really do. You know, if you come around and tell me how great you are, you know, before you know it, me or somebody else gonna think, boy, you're a fool. So Paul realizes that. Okay, but if I'm going to play the role of being a fool right now, at least listen to me. At least listen to me in my foolish boasting of my experiences in the Lord as He has blessed and helped me. You listen to these. So that's what he's saying here. And he's already laid this out earlier there. Excuse me, back there in the first part of this and tail end of chapter 10 for that matter. All right, anyway, he goes on to say in verse 17, I already mentioned this, that which I speak it not after the Lord. He's not following the Lord's pattern here. The Lord never did this. The Lord never had to boast anything about him. He was humble. He lived a humble life. He lived in humility. He never had to boast about anything. He was the true God, the God-man. He never did this. So Paul is stepping away from using the Lord as an example. He's not using the Lord as an example. But he has to because of his audience. All right, he has to because of his audience. But as it were foolishly in this confidence of boasting. 18, he says, seeing that many glory after the flesh, I will glory also. See, this is after the flesh. This is carnal. Glorying in what your achievements is carnal. It's what the Lord works through you. But when they gloried in their achievements, they were glorying in the flesh. Verse 19, he says, for ye suffer fools gladly. He's already said that back in verse 4. These fools will come along, preach another Jesus, another spirit, another gospel. You suffer them gladly, seeing yourselves are wise. See, this is sarcasm. You listen to these fools because you're so wise. I mean, this is sarcasm. You're listening to fools because you're foolish. So he uses this sarcasm, trying to get a point across. There's a place for biblical sarcasm. It's pointed. There are many, many figures in speech that have to be used appropriately. There's irony and metaphor and simile and all kinds of figures of speech. But here he's trying to be pointed towards them. Verse 20, he says, he gives five things that these false apostles were doing. For ye suffer if a man bring you into bondage. You're allowing to be brought into bondage by these men. If a man devour you. Now, not talking about cannibalism here in local church, but he is talking about devouring them, probably financially. They're taking your resources. What in the local church is going on? They're taking your resources. If a man take you, another expression here, in captivity or something. If a man exalt himself, and somebody's marching around exalting himself, there's a red flag there. We all need to be humble before the Lord, not puffed up. And if a man smite you on the face, whether we take that literally or figuratively, he's indicating five characteristics of what these false apostles were doing to the church members. And you'll suffer somebody. You'll suffer somebody smite you in the face. However he meant that. You'll suffer that person. Verse 21, I speak as concerning reproach, as though we had been weak. Howbeit wherein wherein soever any is bold, I speak foolishly, I am bold also. So, if you want to call me weak, I'm going to show you how bold I am to boast in my achievements. So we'll see who's weak and who's bold. I can be as bold as anybody in boasting in my achievements as a fool. I'm going to be bold as a fool. So what do you think about that, fools? What are you saying here? In verse 22, he says, are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they seed of Abraham? So am I. In other words, these false apostles were Jews. They got into the Corinthian church. Now, the churches started to house both Jew and Gentile. And, of course, that would be their strength, their forte. We're not only apostles, but we're Jewish apostles. Originally, that's all there were, Jewish apostles. Now, Paul was a Jew, but then he became a Jew, an apostle to the Gentiles. And then later on, there were some, apparently, who were Gentiles who were sent out as apostles as well. But anyway, he indicates he's a Hebrew. He's an Israelite. He's a seed of Abraham. So they don't have anything on him. They absolutely do not have anything on him. And so we see that the nature of their deceptive minds here, they've been deceived. They'll listen to these people. They're entertained, these false apostles, and want to hear some new truth that they have, a new gospel, a new spirit, a new Jesus. And yet when Paul is trying to deal with them, they kind of put him aside. Now, this is a very lengthy section here. He's saying what he's trying to do. But what he's trying to do here is establish something for pastors in the future generations. Yes. Many of the things I've stated here, Paul is preparing future generations of pastors to be able to deal with these passages because these are some common things. Pastors have the expectation to be remunerated. He indicated that in 1 Corinthians 9. To be respected, and so on and so forth. So he goes through this. He's defending not only his person, which he did earlier, but now he's defending his position as an apostle. All right, so the third point now is not only the nature of the devilish ministers and the nature of the deceptive minds, but now the nature of his defensive mode. He begins to defend himself. He gets into this mode of defending himself, and what the Lord has allowed him in his believer's life to endure for the sake of the gospel. And so here we see he gets into a listing here of many, many things that he has endured. And the whole point of this is, you know, these false apostles, these Jewish false apostles that want to keep you in bondage, what have they endured? They're here for your money. They haven't endured anything for you. They didn't start the church. They haven't taught you for 18 months. They haven't gone through these things. But they're here detracting me and keeping you from following me, and they are wanting to keep you in bondage. So let me tell you a little bit, Paul's saying here, about what I've gone through for your benefit and other Gentiles' benefits. So he starts off here in verse 23. He says, are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more. Of course, they weren't ministers of Christ. They're ministers of the devil. I already made that clear. Are you ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more. So if they claim to be ministers, I'm much more. Why am I much more? Well, let me give you a listing of why I'm much more. And labor is more abundant. All right, so he begins this litany here of various things of which he could boast in the Lord. Labors, the word behind labor has to do with hard work. hard work, labors, and stripes above measure. Aaron, stripes above measure. All right. The word would indicate beatings with rods. So if you look there in Acts, so we're going to go and going back and forth between this passage and Acts. But if you look there in Acts chapter 16, notice 16:23, when he went to Philippi. So when he went to Philippi, he says in 16:23, and when they had laid many stripes upon them, this him and Silas, they cast them into prison, charging the jailer to keep them safely. So here's just one example where he was beaten with rods by the Romans. They did this to hurt him. And this hurt. Beaten with rods. This was no a slap of the hand type thing here. He says, in stripes above measure. I was beaten because I preached the gospel. False apostles, how many times have you been beaten? I've been beaten. And then he goes on to say, in stripes above measure. Stripes above measure. In prisons, more frequent. I mean, he had ongoing prison ministry in which he was the prisoner. He wrote the prison epistles. He was in the Roman prison two times. Prisons more frequent, he says, and deaths off. He faced death regularly. He faced death regularly. Notice our theme song here, Philippians chapter 1, what he says there in the Philippians 1 in the context there. Philippians 1:21, for me to live is Christ and to die is gain. But if I live in the flesh, this is the fruit of my labor. Yet what I shall choose, I wot not. For I am in a strait betwixt two, having a desire to depart, which is and to be with Christ, which is far better. Nevertheless, to abide in the flesh is more needful of you, for you. But Paul realized everywhere he went, he faced possible stoning and death. And so he lived knowing today, as I go out in my evangelistic efforts to try to start more churches among the pagans and the heathens, and with the Jews nipping at my heels, there's a possibility I'll be killed today. Now, we might say, well, yeah, every time I drive to work, I might be in an accident on I-84. That's not what he's talking about. Not what he's talking about. There's real threats to his life. And so mentions that here. We go on here, 2 Corinthians chapter 11. He states as well, of the Jews, five times received I 40 stripes, save one. Now, this is interesting. If you look there in Deuteronomy chapter 25, and verse 3. let's start here in verse 2. Deuteronomy 25, 2. And it shall be, if the wicked man be worthy to be beaten, that the judge shall cause him to lie down and to be beaten before his face, according to his fault, by a certain number. 40 stripes he may give him and not exceed, lest if he should exceed the beat and beat him above these with many stripes, then thy brother should seem vile unto thee. And so the Jews were limited to 40 stripes, 40 beatings. 40 times with the whip, as it were. And here the Jews, being very compassionate, only went to 39, you know. They didn't go to the full 40, they went to 39. But he says this happened five times. Now he's beaten with rods, he's beaten whips. These were serious. Many of these would have been life-threatening. And so he says, of the Jews, five times received by 40 stripes, save one. We're not sure of when all these accounts happened, but they did happen. See, how many times were the false apostles beaten? How many times were they beaten? Can they match this? So here's his list over here, And we look at their list over here, and how many of these items and how many times of these items did they have in contrast to his list? Probably very few, if any. You follow that? See, they weren't called of God to serve in times of hardship. They were there for convenience and for finances. He goes on. Once was I stoned. That was a Lystra. He's left for dead. These stonings had to do with you grab the biggest rock you can and throw it as hard as you can in the shortest distance possible to kill the person. The idea of stoning. Wasn't throwing little pebbles. Let's pebble somebody to death with 1,000 pebbles. No, it was some big, huge stones, how far you could throw a huge stone. And so he was hit with these. No doubt bones would be broken and so on. And he was left for dead. If you look over there in Acts chapter 14, here we have the example of this. Acts chapter 14, and verse 19 says, "And there came hither certain Jews from Antioch and Iconium, who persuaded the people, and having stoned Paul, drew him out of the city, supposing he had been dead." I mean, they knocked him unconscious. They thought he was dead. They took him out of the city. We don't want his body here. And then the next verse says he rose up. This is probably what he's going to record later on, 2 Corinthians chapter 12, when he had this out-of-body experience and the Lord brought him back. I mean, he was dead. He came back. So how many of the false apostles had this occur to them? He goes on, "Thrice was I beaten with rods. Once was I stoned. Thrice I suffered shipwreck. A night and day have I been in the deep." That shipwreck, one example of this is in Acts 27. Acts 27. Now, Luke was there. Luke was writing all this down, apparently in his captain's log, as it were. But in Acts chapter 27, they get caught in a hurricane or a northeaster. That's in verse 14, 27, 14. And yet the Lord appeared to Paul at night in verse 23 and says, "For there stood by me this night the angel of God, whose I am and whom I serve, saying, Fear not, Paul, thou must be brought before Caesar, and lo, God hath given thee all them that sail with thee. Wherefore, sirs, be of good cheer," Paul recounts this, "for I believe God, that it shall be as it was told me." So he tells the men, prisoners and mariners and so on, he tells them, "Lord's revealed to me that we're going to survive this major storm at sea." And Luke goes through recording all this, but notice when the ship lands there, pick it up, verse 42, "And the soldiers' counsel was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim out and escape. But the centurion, willing to save Paul," see, he had responsibility as a Roman citizen, "kept them from their purpose and commanded that they which could swim should cast themselves first into the sea and get the land, and the rest, some of the board, some on boards and some on broken pieces of the ship. And so it came to pass that they escaped all safe to the land." And this was the promise. All 276 of them, back verse 37, would survive this. But Paul was in there. He was out in the sea at the end of this storm and so on. And he ended up on Malta or Melita, the island there. All right, so Paul brings this out. He suffers shipwreck. Verse 26, he just goes into a series here of perils that he faced. "And journeys often, perils of water and perils of robbers," this is verse 26, "and perils of mine own countrymen and perils of the heathen and perils in the city and perils in the wilderness and perils in the sea and perils among false brethren." In other words, he lived a perilous life. And he could go on. He gave many, many details. Now, false apostles, let's see your list. This is my list. Let's see your list. Their list, zero, 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 dash, zero, dash, zero, nothing. That's what Paul went through. All right, so who loves you? Who is concerned for you? Who's willing to put anything forth for your benefit? All right, then we move on here. He indicates, verse 27, weariness and painfulness and watchings often and hunger and thirst and fastings often and cold and nakedness. So here many details. Notice the weariness and painfulness, but the watchings, this would be all night watchings. And hunger and thirst, this was unavoidable. But then he goes on to say, and fastings. He fasted on purpose. So sometimes he didn't have food and drink because it wasn't around. Other times it was around and he fasted. And fasting quite often went along with prayer, the watchings here. And then he concludes all this saying that beside those things which are without, that which cometh upon me daily, the care of all the churches. So he had a real burden and care for the churches. He makes this clear, for instance, in Acts chapter 20. Remember when he poured out his heart to the Ephesian church there, and he met with the elders there in Acts 20, verse 17, and he goes on. Notice he says in verse 19, Acts 20, verse 19, serving the Lord with all humility of mind and with many tears and many temptations, which befell me by the lying in wait of the Jews. So he's talking about how he suffered, how he gave himself over to them and serving the Lord. And he had a care. He had a burden for the Ephesian church. He had a burden for these other churches as well. And so he brings this out. During all this time, I was concerned about other people as well, other churches. Not just your church, but other churches. Now, he's an apostle to the Gentiles and the Gentile churches he started, but he had a burden for them. And then he goes on to say, verse 29, who is weak? And I am not weak. So these were the infirmities, the weaknesses he faced. Who is offended and I burn not? So here talks about the offense and burning over the offense, as it were. Well, who can compare to Paul, you see? If I must needs glory, I will glory in the things which concern my infirmities. So these are the weaknesses that I went through. I have to boast on these because of you. The God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, which is blessed forever, knoweth that I lie not. So he brings this all before the Lord. I'm not embellishing these things. I'm not making these things up. I'm saying this before God, and God knows I'm not a liar. So he doesn't have to swear on a stack of Bibles. He just says, God knows I'm not lying here. This is my testimony. I've gone through that. Now, I've entitled this message, What Happened in Damascus? Because that's where we end up in the chapter. Verse 32 and 33 has to do with Damascus. Damascus, what's this all about? That was a good question. What's this all about? Well, he says, in Damascus, the governor under Aretas, the king, kept the city of Damascenes with a garrison, desirous to apprehend me. And through a window in a basket was I let down by the wall and escaped by his hands. So what's he talking about? Well, let's go back here to Acts chapter 9. See, this is where it all began. This is where it all began. Why does he bring this in? Why does he bring in Damascus? Why does he bring in Damascus? Well, let's notice here in Acts chapter 9. This is Paul's testimony of conversion. He's headed towards Damascus with papers to kill the Christians. The Lord stops him on the road, Damascus Road. He gets saved. He goes to the Damascus church that's already in existence. He gets baptized. All right, that takes us through verse 19 or 18. 19, when he received meat, he was strengthened. Then was Saul certain days with the disciples which were at Damascus, and straightway he preached Christ in the synagogues that he is the Son of God. So he began to preach here. Now, a big change here. He's been converted. Verse 22, but Saul increased the more in strength and confounded the Jews which dwelt in Damascus, proving that this is the very Christ. And after many days were fulfilled, the Jews took counsel to kill him. Now, why did the Jews want to kill him? Because he was, I believe, a member of the Sanhedrin. He was the rising star because he was their the one who killed Christians on their behalf, Acts chapter 7 and going into 8. And so he was their chief henchman. Now the Jews thought he was an apostate. They wanted to kill him and silence him. And so verse 24, but their lying in wait was known of Saul. And they watched the gates day and night to kill him. So he's in the city of Damascus. They're watching the gates. We're going to kill him if he tries to come out. He tries to leave. And verse 25 then says, then the disciples took him by night and led him down by the wall in a basket. And when Saul was gone to Jerusalem, he said to join himself to the disciples. In other words, this was the beginning of his life of suffering for others. So he remembers this. This is where it all began. It had to have a starting place. He's not saying, I'm telling you the end of the story. I've suffered all these things, and here's the tail end of the story. I want to go back to where it all began. Where did it all begin? It began where I got converted, and I had to be led out of the city in a basket, and I began a life of suffering for others. This is where my life began. And this is a fulfillment, by the way, of what's found in Acts chapter 9, when the Lord said to Ananias concerning him in verse 15, but the Lord said unto him, go thy way, for he is a chosen vessel unto me to bear my name before the Gentiles and the kings and the children of Israel, and I will show him how great things he must suffer for my name's sake. See, that's the key. Verse 16 is the key to what he's talking about in 2 Corinthians 11. And so Paul, no doubt, received this revelation from Ananias after he got baptized that he was going to suffer many things for the Lord's sake, the Lord's name's sake. First example of this is what? When the Jews are after him trying to kill him and he has to escape in a basket. And that was the beginning of a life of being pursued by the enemies of the cross and suffering many, many things. It all started back in Damascus. So he thinks back to, this is where it all began. Since I was able to endure that and recognize this is God's will for my life, when the other sufferings came along, he already had the antecedent to it back here. See, and that's what we need to think about as well. When you started off your Christian life, you had your first trial, and you passed your first trial, you might want to think back on that. Okay, I passed that trial. There's going to be more trials. So when the later trials come, you can say, does the Lord ever deliver me out of difficulties? Does he ever deliver you out of difficulties? Yeah, he did way back then. Remember that? He delivered you out of that. So the difficulty you have today, can he deliver you today? He's done it before. So that's why he's bringing it up. So I've entitled the message, What Happened at Damascus? Get that title on there. What happened at Damascus? What happened at Damascus was when he began his life of suffering. And now he can give a whole list and litany there. But on the other hand, if you fail in your early trials, are you going to be able to say, well, the Lord delivers me. He hadn't delivered me yet. I've had all these trials. He never delivered me. No, the idea is he does deliver in the midst of trials. And you can start looking back to them. And you can start to build a life of experience. See, this is what Romans chapter 5 teaches. Let's look there in Romans chapter 5. Paul lays this out. He says in Romans 5, 2, by whom also we have access by faith into this grace, wherein we stand and rejoice in hope of the glory of God. And not only so, but we glory in tribulations also, knowing that tribulation worketh patience, and patience experience, and experience hope. And hope maketh us not ashamed. So we see, we have hope in the Lord delivering us through our next trial. Why? Because we've got experience under our belt. We've experienced this time and time and time again. So you've had trials in your past. You're going to have trials in the future. I'm a prophet. I know this. You're going to have trials in the future. It's going to happen to all of us. It's going to happen to all of us. We're going to have trials. But with the trials, we can say the Lord's delivered me in the past. He can deliver me today as well. And so, have you had your Damascus experience? Paul did, and he could rely back on it. That's why he pulls this out of his long history here of suffering. He goes right back to Damascus. This is where it all started. And we can do the same thing. That we can look at the experiences that we've had in the Lord. Now, I don't think anyone, past or present, can say, here's Paul's list, my list is longer. That's not the point. And the false prophets couldn't say that either. But what we can say is we can all look back to our first Damascus and how the Lord delivered us then and how he can deliver us today as well. And this is what Paul's doing. But you see, he's having to talk as a fool to the Corinthians to indicate, I have so loved you and committed myself to the Lord to serve you that I'll endure anything for you. And these false prophets, they just have you in bondage. You need to forget about bearing them, and you need to start bearing me. Because I'm the one who really cares for you. All right, let's conclude in prayer. Our Father, we thank thee for, again, the message from Scripture here to help us understand the believer's life, understand the difficulties that...